Hello everyone, I'm Louis Vargas and you're listening to episode 12 of the Art Scene Podcast. Today's guest is Mariel Bayona, an artist based out of San Francisco and one of the four co-directors of Boston Rainer Gallery. Today I got to talk to her about her art practice and her experiences growing up in a border town, as well as the sense of duality that came with it. Later on, we talked about how all of this is reflected in a variety of ways in the recent exhibition she curated at Boston Rainer titled El Habito. Before we move on to our conversation, I want to remind everybody to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and to please leave a comment. This will help with our ratings, which will then help spread the word about the podcast. Okay, here's Mariel and I.
Thank you for like meeting up with me and stuff, because I've been looking forward. First of all, Clea and Emily have been talking about me interviewing you, but I'm glad yours, because Clea was explaining a little bit of what your work was in the best way she could. and then I looked up online and I was like, oh yeah, I definitely need to talk to her about this.
It's insane. Even I struggle in explaining my work without blabbing too much, because there's so much going on in my work.
Yeah.
That is so hard to just put it in a nutshell.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
We were supposed to meet in your studio, but fortunately, because I haven't seen the show, the new show that you have here at Boston Rainer, which is called El Habito.
El Habito, yes.
Yeah, and so I'm glad that we actually get to do it here, because I get to actually see it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if you've already seen it. And like I said, like you sort of said, it's my work is a little bit hard to put it in a nutshell and put it into words sometimes, although it just has just filled with language and it changes sometimes when you see it in person. But I'm happy that you get a chance to look at this as well. There's so much going on in this space that is also really worth having that one-on-one experience with both Marcela Pardo, which is the photographer, and Lorena Sertucci, which is the one that did all the installation and sculpture work.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little. I'm going to ask you some more questions about this show, because this is also a very interesting show to me. But I guess I want to start first with asking where are you from? And how did you get to San Francisco?
I am from the border.
Okay.
So it's always interesting when people ask me where I'm from. Most of my life, I would say, it's funny because when I'm in the U.S., I would say I'm from El Paso, Texas, because I was born in El Paso, but I was raised in Juarez. Mm-hmm. So in Juarez, Chihuahua. So when I go to Mexico, I relate more by saying that I'm from Juarez. So normally, especially recently, I've just been saying from the border.
Yeah.
Because it did create a sort of an issue in terms of my identity, where I belong to. And I find that really fascinating, because life in the border is so particular and is so interesting and fascinating. So I think that is what I most fascinating by, just being raised literally on the edge of two different countries and going back and forth as you're growing up. It seems normal when you're growing up, but at the same time, it's really empowering to have that access into two countries, two cultures, two idioms, two languages. So for me, it's been amazing. So I was born in El Paso, raised in Juarez, and didn't come back to the U.S. until I went to high school. So I started high school in my sophomore year in El Paso. So that was my hardcore introduction to American culture, American history, and American customs in general, because in the border is a little bit wishy-washy.
Right. Yes. I grew up in San Diego, and my aunts, mom's like one of 10 kids. So I have nine aunts and uncles all over San Diego.
Mexican family.
Oh, yeah. I have 30 cousins. And, you're right, there's like a duality. I had cousins that lived in like San Ysidro or National City, which is like really close to the border in San Diego, Tijuana. But on the weekends they would go to Tijuana, mm-hmm. and they had another house there that they would stay at and then come back.
Yeah.
And I grew up a little differently, because my mother married, although he's Hispanic as well, but he's American, mm-hmm. more American, and he was a Marine and stuff. So we lived a little bit more like an hour north of like the border, but still in San Diego County.
Mm-hmm.
And
But I remember still my mother would, every weekend during the summer, we went to Tijuana and spend the night there. And it was crazy because my aunt's, the house that we'd stay at, it's pretty third world for the most compared to the suburbs where I grew up. So it was like my mom would just send us there, live there, spend the night on the weekends, and then come home back to like this like suburban, like America.
But doesn't it feel in the border very particularly, since it's right there, you're in a different country, but it doesn't seem so...
No, it felt normal.
It felt normal.
Yeah. And it felt normal to me, and more normal to my cousins who have been doing it a lot longer than me, because mm-hmm. since my dad was in the military, I moved to different places before we settled for the rest of my childhood in San Diego. But you're right. I never thought anything of it. It just felt like, oh, we're going to meet Thea's house this weekend. It's fine.
Especially before 9/11, my dad is in the car business. So he's a car dealer, and he still has a car lot in El Paso. So it was also very normal for us to go back and forth. And my grandparents lived in El Paso for a time. So just go to your grandma's house in El Paso, Texas.
Yeah.
And it was just crossing the border would take 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Or so, which is nothing. I would just cross an American citizen. They would believe you. What are you bringing from Mexico? Yeah. Oh, nothing, sir. Oh, thank you. Go ahead. And after 9/11, just everything just fell apart. A line, like a 2-hour line, 3-hour line to get just to cross the border. And you have to have a requirement, your passport. Right. Just everything just changed. So the idea and the custom of crossing the border also changed.
Yeah.
It was... got pretty crazy. Oh,
I totally have cousins where my aunts on purpose, like, you know, had them in San Diego. Like, mm-hmm. they were born in San Diego, but lived in, like, Tijuana. And they did mm-hmm. that on purpose because before 9/11, it was a little easier as you're growing up to go back and forth where you can still go to school in San Diego and then on the weekends come back to Tijuana. But just by sheer bad luck with 9/11, it didn't work out as planned for them. So they were stuck in Tijuana because it's a lot harder. It was a lot harder for them to go back and forth as what their parents intended it to be.
That's awful.
Yeah, but...
yeah, life on the border is really particular. My parents eventually moved also to El Paso because it's a whole different conversation, but things got hard in Juarez because of the drug wars and all of that. And given the nature that my dad had his business in El Paso, they just had to move.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
So you ended up going to high school in El Paso. How was that after spending basically many years before that in Juarez?
I never really thought about it because there were so many kids from Juarez going to high school in El Paso.
Yeah.
And it's kind of bizarre because I spoke more Spanish in school, in an American school, than English. And it even became a rule. You would go to detention by speaking Spanish because everybody would speak Spanish except the teacher.
Right.
So it wasn't really an American experience. Even throughout college, even though I spoke English and I got more exposed to the language in Spanish, in English, still because of all the drug wars and stuff, a lot of kids my age migrated to San Antonio, which was where I lived, is where I finished my college degree. So I was still hanging out with all the Mexican kids and all the Mexican communities. But at the same time, growing up in the border, you learn to, well, my particular case is to, you separate yourself in terms of identity because you relate. I related a lot to people my age that were American, and I got really fascinating just like by getting exposed to different people from different countries and different cultures, but at the same time having that halfway of meeting and relating to each other. And I started to get really fascinated by that. And so this sort of separation from your old identity starts to arise, right? When you start relating to other people that you're not accustomed to see, which is sort of what I talk about a little bit here, but that's been really fascinating to me, especially by living in the border, to have that openness to accept other people that are not really the way that you do or have the same opinions that you do, but you're willing to respect that and not only coexist with them, but actually relate to them, which is as a point that is sort of lacking, I feel. I'm really cheesy, by the way, and I'm very overly romantic and naive in some of the ways that I think. So just FYI. So I did my college years in San Antonio. I did my BFA in painting. I actually started in 3D animation and...
This is once you're in undergrad.
Once I was in undergrad,
Where did you go?
I went to a tiny, tiny, tiny school called University of the Incarnate Word. Okay. It's a private Catholic university. I mean, Texas is just filled with them.
Oh, tons.
And I was really interested in animation at the time, and that was the only good, solid program that I thought would be a good fit for me.
Yeah.
Especially because my sister was moving there. It was either San Antonio or Dallas at the time, and I just went for San Antonio. The program was really good because it was really exclusive. You had to go through a one-year trial, and then you submit your portfolio, and only a handful of students would get in.
Oh.
So I was really intrigued by that, and I got in.
Yay.
But I started pursuing art classes and my love for painting and drawing, and I started realizing how well I was developing in that area, in that genre. And in animation, it's still this sort of big love that, I mean, I'm a huge film fan and I'm a film buff, and especially animation. So, but at the same time, the work and the lifestyle wasn't for me. Just sitting in a computer, I'm more active and I like to be more physical with my body and what I do and what I can create with a certain movement or just a gesture of my body. And that was, I think that was the thing that sold me to fine arts instead of just sitting in a computer and building something with just my hands and not using the entire thing of, which is my body and movement.
And was this, so your passion for animation, that was that, how far did that go? Was it something you picked up in high school or when you were little, like just when you were drawing a little bit? Like, was art like kind of always a presence since you were a kid that led you to go this path of animation and then fine art?
Well, I think it's because I actually learned how to speak English. I have a good accent just because me and my sisters grew up watching only Disney movies in English.
Oh, yeah.
We had all the collection of Disney movies and animation movies in pure English, mm-hmm. and also those sing-alongs with the Mickey on top, bouncing on top of the lyrics.
Mm, yeah.
That's how we started also relating words into reading. And of course, we took a lot of English class, given the nature that there was a border.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that triggered something in me. And I was also a middle child, the middle child. It was really fascinating because my sisters all three of us have a little bit of a strong character.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned how to isolate myself and let them be by me isolating myself and watching a movie,
mm-hmm.
watching a cartoon. So that fascination of me detaching into something imaginative or fantastic even started to become my isolation. And sometimes when I felt sad as a kid, I would just go and watch a movie, and that would make me sort of detach from my reality. And I sort of loved detaching into something fantastical and unreal and animated. And that's when I started to get really into it, I think. And of course, I'm a self-taught drawer. I mean, I'm a self-taught artist, so I started drawing by myself, and I used to actually just click pause on stills on one of the Disney movies and copy the character from that. So that was mostly my drawing classes too. So I feel really related to animation in general, and especially the world of Disney and how that opens up into even a more deeper love into film. How do you create motion pictures and the magic and the massive work into a movie production? So I also just grew up with watching a lot of, aside from that, I watched a lot of sci-fi, Star Trek with my dad, mm-hmm. growing up, and Star Wars was huge in my house. Alien. I watched a lot of Alien growing up. So I was really, my parents were really open about us watching movies. We were never limited to watch any rated R movies either.
Right.
They would just say, close your eyes. But. It's just closer. So I think that's what really pulled me into pursuing a career in animation. But at the end, I think the traditional aspect and the classic aspect of art making is something that really intrigued me. Also, it's funny because I think it was in high school that my high school counselor really started to encourage me. I was going to say push, but no, he encouraged me to apply to art schools and take a look and to actually build a portfolio and to apply. I think it was Otis that he really wanted me to go.
In LA, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, like growing up in the border and there's sort of more like a conservative mentality. How are you going to make a living out of being an artist?
Yeah.
You're just going to waste your time. You're never going to make any money.
Yeah.
That's the reality of it. So I sort of not failed. I had that sort of mentality. How the heck am I going to live? I think from the get-go, I knew that being that idea of being famous, like a famous artist, is being that 1% of being in the right place at the right time. It doesn't just take talent. It also takes luck.
Yeah.
And a lot of luck and just finding the right people when in the exact same moment. And that's, and of course, me coming from the border of Chihuahua and Texas, where you have kids already like in LA, yeah. It just seems something so platonic. And maybe I thought an animation is something more that you can work on because it's not only film, there's even military programs that you have to do renders of for training programs, and I did a lot of research on it.
It seemed that like it seemed more marketable as an actual occupation.
Yeah, and I can put my talents into good use.
Right.
But no, that's when I discovered how I felt this sort of freedom when I started painting and art making, because I wasn't only creating characters or landscapes or situations, I was creating my own language.
Yeah.
And sort of detaching from the idea of a customer, mm-hmm. and pleasing a customer. I was just being image vomit.
Yeah, your creativity was starting to flow out of it into it.
And I was starting to find myself a little bit too. When I started getting my eye on San Francisco, it's because I did a summer residency for undergrads just a semester before I graduated from my BFA, and it was serendipity. I knew I wanted to go to grad school, but I wanted to wait a little bit, and I just came across an email, or it was an online ad, I can't remember, and I applied just for them.
So that was it? You just saw an online ad for like, oh, SFAI offering this like...
Yeah, this new... And it was the first year also, so they were experimenting with this new year of undergrad residency, and I just figured, what the heck?
Yeah.
But yet again, San Francisco or in California, and this idea of me being here, it seemed so platonic and far away.
Have you ever been to California before then?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've been to San Francisco, mm-hmm. and I had an experience that the city sort of called me. It was really weird. But yet again, this is me being overly romantic. I went into a gallery, those horrible galleries in Fisherman's Wharf. So, but
it's okay.
The salesperson in the gallery asked me, are you an artist or whatever? And I was like, well, in the making. Because I always felt uncomfortable to mark myself as an artist and to declare myself as an artist. I feel that I'm still developing. And I always consider myself an artist in the making a little bit.
And I think that's normal. I mean, even when I was an undergrad, I remember, because I did photography as an undergrad.
Oh, yeah.
And I was a photographer, and I was making fine art, but it was really hard for me to call myself an artist, because I felt like I had to like actually have an art show first before I considered myself an actual artist.
Yeah.
But I had a friend in college who told me that the sooner I told myself and accepted that I was an artist,
mm-hmm.
the sooner I would stop being afraid of making what I could potentially make. I remember that was the big advice, which is hilarious because I don't make art anymore as much. I mean, I still photograph, but not not for fine art purposes. I don't think I've tapped into those creative juices in that way.
Do you miss it though?
Oh yeah, I totally. Like I collect cameras and I still like develop my own, like process my own film and like,
really?
So yeah, and I know how to use the darkroom and all that stuff, and I do digital and I'm really good still at Photoshop, but I don't think I think I took one art class during, because I was an MA student, not an MFA student. I took one art class in the first year at SFAI, and that was the last time I was like actual art. And it felt good,
yeah.
But then I got busy with like other classes that I had to take.
With your thesis?
Yeah, like my thesis.
Like your thesis?
Yeah, it's yeah.
It's really fascinating because I was talking to one of my studio mates the other day, and it's sort of laws of attraction. You, when you're sort of going through a period of an artist block or something, and you refuse to make work because you're in a block or you don't have any time or whatever, but you start making work and you start releasing that acceptance that you're making work. So you release that good sort of vibe and good things to start to develop, either if it's material, you didn't have any money to buy any material, it just starts falling into your lap, or X or Y reasons, everything starts to fall apart. So I think it's sort of the same about not accepting that you're an artist, but once you do, it starts to flow. Oh, it makes total sense.
Yeah.
When I first came to San Francisco, and I remember where I was going with this.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, where do you live? And I was, San Antonio. And he didn't mean it in a pretentious way. Oh, what are you doing there? I sort of showed him, I have some photos in my BlackBerry. I remember that I had a BlackBerry at the time. And he looked at some of the photos, and he had a... sort of took a pause and looked at me and asked me, what are you doing there? You should be here or LA or get yourself out there. And there was something that I was sort of going on the back of my mind, but yet again, you're limited and enclosed because I felt that it was something so far away, given the small town that I'm from and the baby steps. And in a way, I already felt behind to pursue, and I was 20, 21?
Yeah, you're like still in college.
I was still a baby.
Like, I'm so behind.
No, that was even, I think I was 18 at the time.
Wow.
That was 10 years ago. And then a few years later, this ad from SFAI, this residency just fell into my lap. And I figured, why not? I have nothing to lose. And it would be just a summer. Things got really complicated in San Francisco. Living expenses and of course, SFAI did not cover any of the living expenses, even though I was the only student coming from...
And this is once you're starting the MFA program.
No, this was...
This is just the residency.
The residency,
wow.
Yeah. That was, I think, a year before my junior year in college... That summer between junior year and senior year is when I did the residency. But everything just started to get really complicated. I don't even remember why it was getting so complicated. That my mentor was just, he sat me down because I was so determined to come. And he sat me down and he just looked at me and was like, just let it go. It's okay. You don't have to go. You work here. It's not the end of the world. It's not the end of the world. You can research if you like the MFA, and of course I'm really stubborn, and I just said no, and I figured out a way to make a budget and come here to live for almost 4 months, and I ended up living in a retirement home.
Wait, how did that work?
In a hotel residency that is a retirement home for old people.
You didn't have to be old to be at
No,
this
they had a student special, but they never had students, and I was the only, I think I was the first student living there in 5 years or something. I started living in a small residency hotel on California and Larkin.
Yeah.
And Pride month came in and the prices just skyrocketed because I was week to week basis. So I paid every week. And I remember that next week it doubled the price.
Wow.
And since I had a limited budget, I couldn't afford it.
Right.
And I tried to negotiate, nothing. And I started researching all the hotel residencies, nothing Pride month,
right.
Everything bucked. Right.
The holidays, basically.
Oh, it's horrible. So I ended up after, I'm not kidding you, 40 calls. The last lady asked me if I knew, have you ever heard of the Granada Hotel? And I was just like, no. And you should call them. They're always open. They always. And I didn't even think it through. I just called them, and they had the student special.
Yeah.
And they included three meal courses a day. And it was really, I was even going to pay less than what
wow.
I was paying. And I was just thinking to myself, what a deal. How did I get so lucky? And I was really lucky at the end. But before hanging up with the manager, his name was Mike. He asked me, well, have you heard about us? You've researched us, right? And I was, no, I mean, you're the Granada Hotel, you're in Sutter and Hyde. No, I think you should go on a website. How do you relate to the elderly? I was, I relate to them really well.
I love old people.
And he just, he told me, I'll let you take a look at our website and then call me back if you're still interested. And at that point, everything just started to come together. I was like, oh no. But it wasn't a problem. And of course, I had no other option. So I just ended up living there for almost 3 months. And it was honestly the most surreal, bizarre, but best experience of my life. Because this place is a hotel, is a 10-story building, but all of the residents, of course, they're old people. And they haven't left the building in, most of them, in 35, 40 years. So they have no knowledge whatsoever of the outside world, what is happening in the city in San Francisco, except
wow.
what they watch in TV.
Yeah.
So imagine walking into this building that is a world of its own.
Yeah.
And it's so bizarre because it used to be glamorous, but everything is decaying. And, of course, the smells are really interesting, if you can imagine. And then in my hallway was this, and all of the hallways were particular because they had this sort of a German rustic feeling. It was red hallways, red floors, red walls. Everything was red except the wood of the furniture, this like lion with lion claws, and everything was just really dark and smelly, but you can felt that sort of old glamour into it. And I have so many bunch of stories, both sad, funny, and bizarre and surreal, that I've been wanting to write about it, actually, because I have so many stories.
this is all in one summer.
Yeah.
You get this residency program, you have issues with trying to find a place, and you find a place and it's an old folks home, basically.
Yeah.
So you're interacting with old people
all the time. And I think that affected my social skills, because I get along better now with old people than with people my age.
I mean, it could be a good thing to have that skill.
Not really, because I'm surrounded more often with people my age than with old people, unless I I'm a creep and I just like to look for hanging out with old people, which is those things happen, but this one story real quick, I think it's my favorite. At the end of the day, they were going to do a tour to the MoMA. It was still open.
Mm-hmm.
They do like regular field trips and stuff. And the guy with special events,
uh-huh.
he had a plan of taking the old folks to the tour, to the field trip, and come back for them to be waiting with a portrait of him.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he knew that I was an art student, and he offered me a job to take photos, take their portraits, and then draw them and to give it to them after the field trip or whatever. And of course I said yes. But he put, and you, when you look at me, you can, there you can see the ad. It's like Picasso in the Granada, Mariel Bayona doing all portraits, and he printed them. And at the bottom, he wrote, "Don't be shy. If you want your portrait taken, just say hi to Mariel." And of course, everybody knew who I was because I was the only young person in there. So I'm not kidding you. I did around 50 drawings and portraits of him. And it took a lot of energy because it wasn't like, oh, hi, click and leave. No, I was talking to them, everybody. And I found it really interesting because everybody wanted to talk and to sit with you and to tell you a story and to tell you what reason why they were there. So it became also this sort of relationship with them. And most of them were really sad. They were just abandoned and stuff. But that's also a different story. Long story short, I ended up living in an old retirement home. That was my first experience living in San Francisco. So, of course, after that, how can you not fall in love with an experience like that? And right. Especially being an artist and SFAI being my introduction into a more conceptual thinking in terms of art making and not just technical, which is the way that I was trained through my BFA, very hardcore, traditional and technical. And then to start thinking that it's okay to have something more to say than just a good technique, that you can really explore what you want to say and create your own statement through your artwork. I think that was mind-blowing to me. So I came back.
Yeah, so like now you're like done with the summer now. You learn all of this.
Yeah.
Like, and you still got to do a senior year in San Antonio still. So how was that last year? Were you just like ready? Was it like weird transitioning back to San Antonio? And then like, and were you like still pining to go back to San Francisco then at that point?
I think I came back and I think that would be the most intense point of my life where I felt that I didn't belong somewhere. That I felt really torn. I felt that I came back with all these new ideas. I was doing really weird. It wasn't weird. It was actually kind of beautiful. I was manipulating masking tape and creating this sort of sculptural on flat surfaces. And they didn't look like masking tape. They look almost like palm trees or folded fabric.
Yeah.
So
now you're getting into more sculptural work.
I was getting more into, yeah.
Yeah.
I came with this idea and interrupting everything that I sort of built all those 3 years in the program, and all of a sudden switching into this a little bit more, well, conceptual.
Right, yeah.
Non-figurative and more abstract in a way. And even what I was thinking about, what I was trying to say, it was more about that meditative process and the action. It was more process based than anything else, and that confused my professors a little bit.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Right. What happened?
What happened?
This is good. Yeah.
To you? So.
So now you graduate, right? You graduate from your school in San.
Oh, and I had an open door here in SFAI.
Right. Did you immediately, right afterwards, come to San Francisco?
Yeah, I didn't lose touch. I think that was the advantage. I think I was ready.
Yeah.
To just continue what I was awakening.
Right.
And I didn't lose touch with the people here at SFAI, so that was also pretty awesome.
Right.
And they just helped me to keep the door open for me when I came back. And it was easy. It was really easy.
And you came back, got your MFA. What was now your specialty, I guess, at this point?
I got into the sculpture program.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because I applied with all my tape series, my masking tape series, and a little bit of sculpture, like experimental sculpture. And I considered them paintings.
Right.
But I wasn't opposed to the idea of me being more like a sculptural realm.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did my 2 years here as a sculptor, but it was fascinating that to go into my most experimental, all of a sudden I came back to my basics, which is drawing and more traditional sculpture and ceramic.
Well, I was going to say, because you have some ceramic, some sculpture work, but majority of the recent work has been back to drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you about that because I was looking at your recent work. You have to explain it to me because it's the way. And now that I know you have this sci-fi background, like you love sci-fi, you grew up watching Disney and cartoons and stuff. We'll describe it. I guess they'll talk about it because the drawings are of these made-up species or animals, right?
Well, the whole fundamental. I promise that my blab has a reason. The fundamentals of it is my fascination of race,
okay,
of how mixed we are, and especially people that we grew up in the border. A few years ago, I found out that I have German blood in me, and you can't even tell.
Right.
So it's been. So aside from that, my isolation and my fascination for the fantastic and the unreal has been really a huge part of my life. It's also a huge part of the Mexican culture.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know about the alebrijes.
Mm-hmm.
They're these small, for the people that don't know.
Yeah.
They're these small, very colorful little monsters that you buy anywhere in Mexico, and that they're basically the Mexican version of a dream catcher.
Mm-hmm.
They protect you from nightmares. And I love those also growing up. And especially when you go to Mexico, you can paint them. You can paint the ceramic version of them, and you paint them with acrylic. And that was always my favorite part of going to a beach in Mexico. So all those influence, and of course, mythology, once you start reading about more into history and mythological creatures are a huge part, even in philosophy, the metaphors that you start creating. So I just started creating a mesh of unidentified animals. And my biggest influences, especially during my BFA, were the female Mexican surrealists,
mm-hmm,
like Remedios Varo, Leonora Carrington, Frida Kahlo, not so much, because she was more into expressing feelings and portraying herself.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the darkness that she brought into her work. But Remedios Varo and Leonora Carrington, they're just they just create these worlds and creatures that only in their head exist. And they're sort of whimsical nature of them, but at the same time, they're in touch with their dark side, which I think this is where the idea of just creating these animals came up. And Leonora Carrington, which is how I opened my statement,
mm-hmm,
is they're so stubbornly mixed, undetermined, that they can barely be called monsters.
Yeah.
I this is sort of like my motto.
Well, you even created names for them, combining Nahuatl language, which is the Aztec language, but combining it with, like, I mean, there was one that was like it was an ocelot, basically, but you like made it sound like Aztec, like with native Aztec language.
Ocelot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the other is just that my drawings are divided in two. The birth of the creature is that in tune of me and my meditative states.
Mm-hmm.
All my drawings start with the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And the creature, the drawing itself just develops on its own. So it starts growing as I just start drawing,
mm-hmm,
right? Coming everything from my mind, my subconscious, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then it comes the research aspect of it. I'm working on a series of 21 drawings, which I am basically I'm basing this series on the Aztec calendar itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the calendar is divided in rings. And in one of the rings, it has 21 symbols, which is the zodiac signs and the different days,
mm-hmm,
in the calendar. So I'm basing each drawing on each symbol in the calendar. And aside from that, since I've been really drawn into the idea of language,
mm-hmm,
and communication, especially how people relate to the visual, to symbols. We grew up surrounded by symbols, and people always relate to that. And there's always some excitement when people find symbols that they know.
It's
kind of fascinating. So I pick a symbol that I make a drawing based on the specific symbol in the calendar, and then I research the meaning in other symbols that have similar meanings, and I start creating patterns of all the symbols combined that I can find. Mm-hmm. And some of them are really, really hidden, and some of them are really, really obvious, but they always, they sort of create this universal super symbol, if you will. And it's sort of that idea of unifying and relating to everybody and having a momentum with these creatures, which can also, I see them and relate to them also as a somewhat a protector. It's really fascinating. So that's, of course, a long blab in a nutshell. But
I'm seeing, and particularly in these drawings, the duality that you grew up having with living on a border town,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, it's really showing in these drawings, you know, the combination of the English language word for whatever the species was your inspiration, and with names or accents, like language, like combined the two.
Yeah.
So it's like you're mixing definitely the two cultures, which I think, and I totally understand this because my growing up, it was the same for me. It's really the mixing of two cultures, and which seemed natural.
And isn't it interesting because it's undefined but defying. You can understand it, but at the same time, it's so oblivious,
right.
And it's so. And that's why that's also one of the reasons why my creatures, or my tesquanis, mm-hmm. as I call them, tesquanis means. Fiera in Spanish, which is beast, or in English, they're always floating into some sort of limbo. They're mm-hmm. never, there's never a narrative. I'm really interested in people just creating the narrative by themselves, because that's sort of how I feel when I grew up. I literally grew up in the limbo, in this place of in between.
Right.
And for me, it's been between two countries, between two sisters, between all of these things going on, and in almost in every aspect of my life, I always, when I explain things to people, oh, where do you live? Oh, West Portland is between Twin Peaks and Sunset. And I always, that's the way that I relate, as long as I'm in some sort of in between something. So that's how my creatures are. They're just floating, or there's this stillness of floating of some action that they're doing, but there's always a stillness, an in-betweenness that is happening, that it almost makes you stop breathing for a second when you take a photo, or when something happens. I want to feel that in-betweenness of either time or space or form, shape or form. That in-betweenness is something that I'm really interested to.
Yeah.
And of course, going into more technical is awesome, which is also a little bit of a problem that I have in terms of documenting the work. Since it's so highly in detail, some things cannot really be appreciated in camera. And there's always this going back and forth, looking at the drawing. And it's really easy to isolate parts of the animal because there's so much happening in every single part of the animal.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a moment that, since you're going back and forth, the audience is sort of also in this in between. So it's magic. I love it. Yeah, I love it when that happens. So.
I want to ask you, do you consider yourself Chicana?
No.
Okay.
And that's also, I think that's something that I found it kind of hard for me to stay in San Antonio. I feel that my work goes a little bit beyond of just being Mexican, of being American, or being Chicana.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've never considered myself either of those things. And it comes back to my issue of identity growing up between these two countries. Since I think you can call it an advantage or a disadvantage, or a blessing or a curse, that I was so exposed to both of the cultures,
mm-hmm.
the traditional aspect of Mexican culture and the traditional more openness of American culture. And I never had the mixture of both. So I was so exposed to both of them growing up that I wasn't able to identify with either. I had so much, I gained so much from this, from, I mean, my, all my base, my principles and my heart base is from Mexican, but developing it at a younger age, I have a lot of American customs. Mm-hmm. I feel that I don't belong to either of the three. Yeah. And this is still something that I struggle with, and to say where I really belong.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you live, and it's sort of what I'm doing also with Boston Rainer and my, this sort of directorial, curatorial work and my artist practice. And it's the same with my daily basis, which is kind of fascinating to me to realize this. When I'm in the U.S., I think more American and I think more relating to these people. But when I'm back home, I say, no, I'm not American. Of course, I'm Mexican. I mean, we're, and speaking also like in Spanish, it makes me think that way.
Yeah.
And but it's two parallel worlds.
Oh, yeah.
That is... two dimensions even.
Yeah.
It's going back and forth between the two it's insane. It's a switch that you have to turn on and off every time.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean.
And it's kind of, and it's hard.
It is. It's you know, my dad's Peruvian Chilean, as I mentioned before, but he was born in New York and raised in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, I'm not Hispanic, I'm American. Like if you, it's pretty funny, and he's Republican, and he was in the military. He's an immigration agent. He's an ICE agent.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what he does for a living. And my mother was born and raised in Tijuana,
mm-hmm.
immigrated illegally, mm-hmm. got amnesty during the Reagan years, met my father, got married.
Wow.
You know, this is like before. You know, she became a citizen because she married my father, but she was legal.
Yeah.
She had her green card beforehand. But I remember growing up. You know, in the household, we spoke Spanish. And luckily, my father spoke Spanish, too, so he spoke Spanish as well. But I think as we got older and started going to school, and we lived in the suburbs, and my parents purposely had us move in a suburbia area
mm-hmm.
compared to closer to downtown San Diego on the border
mm-hmm.
because they didn't want us growing up speaking Spanglish. They want us, like, my mother used to tell me, it's either English or Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to speak Spanish, speak it all the way through, finish the sentence. And then if you're going to switch over to English, finish the sentence in English.
That's so awesome.
But, you know, but I had to do that. Like, I mean, I support the Mexico soccer team. I never grew up watching U.S. soccer.
Yeah.
Hated it. I grew up watching Mexican soccer. But during the
Olympics. Who did you go for?
America.
No!
My mother. my mother was that. I mean, that was her team. And
I was a Chivas fan, so.
Oh, my brother's godfather used to play for the Chivas back in the day. He was like a backup goalie or something for the Chivas. So when they would play, it was quite a bet between my mother and my brother's godfather.
That's so funny.
Oh yeah, no, and I would do that. I was going to school in suburbia. Everyone spoke English, American. And my hometown is where it's a Marine Corps base.
Mm-hmm.
It's Camp Pendleton. So, like, a lot of the kids I went to school with, majority of them were sons and daughters of Marines
mm-hmm.
or military. And so it's very American centralized and very American inspirational and, like, which is great. It's really good. But then on the weekends, when I go visit my aunts and stuff, you had to turn it back on. I only spoke Spanish because they didn't speak English. And then I was like Mexican all the way through.
Yeah.
Like, and then Monday, go back to school and you had to turn it back off.
It's a different identity almost.
Yeah. And it was so weird because I played football. I took AP classes. I applied to college. I went to homecoming dances. My cousins didn't do really stuff like that. I had a Letterman jacket, like very American. Like,
yeah.
But then on the weekends, it was like turned off. And switched off. And for the same reason, that's why I don't consider myself Chicano. Nothing against the Chicanos.
No.
It's just I don't ever think I fit them, like that category, because Chicanos are more like fifth, fourth generation.
And
Mexican,
it's a culture in itself.
Right. Yeah, Mexican Americans that have been in the States dating back to Spanish, the colonization of Spain or
mm-hmm.
of Mexico by the Spanish. So for me, it was like, I don't fit that.
Yeah.
I have an immigrant mother and a father who was like Americanized and never fit.
And it's fascinating. And, well, it's really interesting for me because you do relate to them, but you relate to them as an outsider.
Yeah.
Not as part of la raza, how they call them.
Yes.
You know, and there was always this line, especially in San Antonio, the Chicano community is huge. And I never felt, at least in my work, my practice, as part that I was talking about the same thing as they were. So I felt that I needed to look somewhere else in terms of how I wanted to develop. And I knew that I was still developing and trying to find myself. And I knew that that wasn't what I was talking about. So.
Yeah. It's I told my fiance this. Mexicans and Mexican Americans, like, they have some of the, I think they have the biggest identity crisis of any race, because to be honest, like, if you're Mexican American, you can be Chicano or you could be American. Sometimes, depending on your family members, you're Mexican, right? But sometimes you don't ever really fit neither one, which is why even the Chicano was even created. And then even like situations like us, where we lived in border city towns and counties, where and we had family in Mexico, and we had family in America, and you went back and forth a lot, yeah, visiting them. You know, you really are stuck in this limbo, like this kind of this like this middle ground, and we're not the only ones. There's tons of us like this.
And there's always, and I think about it a lot, is, well, you choose. I had this particular moment when me and my family, we went on a trip a couple of, I think it's going to be 2 years ago, and everybody, and it was Thailand, and people will always ask us, and it was really bizarre, because one time they asked me and my sister, we were sort of not together, but we were sort of together. Mm-hmm. And they asked me, where are you from? And I said, Mexico. And then they asked Carla, my sister, where are you from? And she said, Texas. Everyone was like, what?
Yeah.
And she said, you should say you're from Texas. You were born in Texas. And I said, yeah, I was born in Texas, but I was raised in Juarez. What language are we speaking right now? Spanish. So we got into this conversation of what we were, and we never got into a conclusion of what we really are.
Yeah.
So even at this age, it's we don't even know who we know.
And in reality, you're both. I mean, that's really it. And
there's nothing wrong with being both.
No, not at all. And it's hard, I think, for some people to understand that, because it's like, you can't both be one or the other. No, I'm both, because this is literally my situation. I didn't live, I wasn't born in the States. Mm-hmm. Like, I wasn't born in Mexico or California. I was born in Island Guam, because my dad was in the military.
Even more of a limbo.
Yeah. I consider San Diego my hometown, but I wasn't born and raised in it.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up there, but I wasn't born there. My brother's the only one that was born there. Kids.
Oh.
Yeah, but which is even crazier, right?
Crazier.
Yeah. So then the question is, on your end, it's safe to say you didn't decide. You decided to accept both, and that's your identity.
Yeah, I think of myself a little bit of a hybridity myself, yeah, because I mentioned before, I relate so much to the culture and the openness in American culture and the freedom sometimes that we can have in this country, and just to be ourselves, the embracement of being oneself. I think it's amazing. But yet again, I was raised in a more conservative, yeah, and I mean, if you ask me about history, I know every single holiday in Mexico, and I struggle with the holidays here, you know?
Yeah.
You can tell me, ask me the names of the, I can name states and capitals in Mexico, and I can pinpoint where all the states are, but I have no, my geography in the United States, it's, I have no clue.
Yeah.
States and capitals, maybe. So, you know, that's sort of this, right, there's small things that make a huge difference in my identity. So I just decided to be a hybrid. But to reflect, honestly, it surrounds my work.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good
and,
one. That's
and
a good
people that know me, you can totally see it because I'm always sort of bouncing. And that also affected my personality. I'm always bouncing everywhere.
Yeah.
And I also learned to be a mediator of things, which is also awesome.
Well, all right. So let's go back to SFAI. So you're done with SFAI.
Yeah.
You finished SFAI. Now it's like the months after graduation. What are you doing within these few months that Boston Rainer start to come into the picture, right?
Yeah.
So how did that formulate? How did you go from recent grad from graduate school and like many of us, sort of jobless, sort of part-time worker to now, you know, to creating Boston Rainer?
Oh boy, it all happened so quickly, but we were working, I think we just got exposed to, I mean, coming out of grad school, we were so spoiled in this liberty and freedom to, and the beauty of showing artworks, right? Mm-hmm. And having the accessibility of showing artists and me, myself showing. And then all of a sudden going into the dark side, like a dark corner in the art community and in a more commercial way and in a way greedy.
Yeah.
It opened because Clay and I were working in the same gallery and we sort of hit rock bottom in terms of we don't want this, right? And especially was a time when the art scene in San Francisco was starting to turn off a little bit.
Yeah.
And I was just surrounded by this scene and I figured that we needed to do something, either if it's just for us and our friends, something small. And I knew that it was going to take most of my income. And aside from that, sacrificing a lot more in terms of my artwork. But at the same time, I was so, from my BFA to now, I was so used to being involved in a gallery and an art space in general, because in my BFA, I interned for this artist that was opening his gallery. So I designed all the contracts and I helped him build the gallery. And then before graduating, I was an arts writer. So I wrote for an art magazine. And then I always liked to be involved in something. And during grad school, I ran the Diego. So I always liked to have the hands-on and just run a space or be involved in something greater than myself and my practice. So we found this place, for rent, and it was cheap-ish.
Right.
It was affordable.
And it was over by Cap Street, right?
Yes, yeah. It was in the Mission, yeah. And I remember Clay and I went to see the space. We had no clue where we were getting ourselves into. We just went for it. And right there and there, the landlord asked us for an application or if we had like a solid concept in mind in terms of the gallery or the space that we were going to run. And right there and there, we made up a concept and it worked and it clicked. And four of us got together and we started brainstorming and just making a plan of what we were going to do. And everything was so easy and fluid, and we made a good balance in terms of the idea. It everything just clicked.
Yeah.
When it's meant to be, it's sort of meant to be, and that's how Boston Rainer was born. But for me personally, it was just to keep the city active, at least inside our community. To start with our community, and if it expanded, then it would.
Yeah.
And it was, I think we all came on board with the best intentions to help our friends in the community, that we were sort of looking a little bit of dark times in terms of the scene, the whole scene itself in San Francisco.
And now you're also a curator. Now you got that too.
Yeah, this is my second show.
So now you're curating shows at Boston Rainer, which is now housed at the Minnesota Street Project here in San Francisco. Let's talk about the latest show, El Habito. So tell me about why you came up with the title, I guess when, why you decided to do this show, and when you, how you met Marcela and Lorena.
So I've been thinking about this show literally all year. There's something you need to know about the way that I curate and the way that I love to talk about shows that is not through my work. Mm-hmm. I think is that I talk about issues that I can't necessarily talk through my work.
Okay.
And most of my issues that I want to express are generational issues. The gasp and the differences between my generations and my parents, which I feel that they're the middle ground between us and our grandparents. And the differences are huge. And El Hábito talks, I wanted to express a little bit more of the changes and the alterations in habits and traditions. And the way, just the way the changes, just the changes in general that is happening and the acceptance of it. And I think we've been talking about this show all year, but I think I decided to wait for this month particularly, because of course I was bringing Colombian artist and a Mexican artist, and what a better month to do it, an election month.
Which sadly didn't turn out the way we wanted it to be. But
well, we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
But so we decided to wait until November, and of course Marcela, I met her while she was doing her BFA in SFAI. And Lorena I met because she has a local business here in the city, and I'm a huge fan. So I was introduced to her, I think around the same time I started really talking to Marcela. And I have a really huge interest in just embracing the Hispanic culture, and especially women. And it's not in a feminist way. It's just in a way that it intrigues me to see something different every time I enter a gallery, right? And I think there's some sort of feeling of breaking also the habits of a traditional gallery setting is something that I'm always aiming for. I love to shows to be interactive and submersive, and for the audience to feel that escape that I'm looking for when I go and see a movie, or what I want to obtain when I go in to see an art show, that escape of reality and just that moment of stillness and enjoy and be present in time or whatever. So I see this show as also like a series of reactions, because I introduced them both. For people that don't know the work of Marcela Pardo, she's a photographer that creates settings and sets in her studio and captures and photographs them. But she talks a lot about identity and embracing the queer culture, and also questioning the roles of gender in society in general. But she's highly colorful, but there's this sort of minimal nature and aspect to her work that makes it really unique. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to access, but there's also this wonder that sort of captures you. And she's really creative and breaking the habits of traditional photography and taking it into another level, which is also fascinating. And Lorena, she is not the typical artist that you would expect. She's been mostly inclined into the design realm. And she's an artist in itself, but she didn't realize it at first. But she's a powerful artist that she recollects and recycles furniture, or finds objects and creates a functional object, either a lamp or a desk or a table, and creates living objects and functional furniture and objects to people to live with. But it's this highly kitschy, over the top objects.
Yeah.
And they speak a little bit more into the Rancheria culture. Mm-hmm. Mexica Rancheria culture, which has this sort of ranch cowboy feeling, but very highly kitschy Mexican. Mm-hmm. So they're completely different and opposite. But Lorena's also speaking about her identity as a woman and how her role as a housewife or a working mother and her, then how she balances this gender role in her on her daily basis. So that's why she uses a lot of cleaning objects and cleaning products and her work. And she relates a lot into her past experiences with the furniture that she makes. So she's talking a lot about a lot of stuff in her work. Each piece has its unique story, which I think it's also very fascinating. So I have these two girls doing completely different practices, but at the same time, dealing with the same thing that I'm sort of dealing with also, right, which is an issue of identity, mm-hmm, and an issue of roles and how being a woman is not really, especially if you grew up in a Hispanic, yeah, in a Hispanic culture, you were born to be married and to be a housewife and to have the regular woman,
right,
role.
Well, and then there's the culture of machismo.
Hispanic culture as well. But that's sort of disappearing. Well, yeah, but it still exists really hardcore.
Yeah.
So is this sort of also this dialogue of where are we? Which point are we as? And it's also fascinating because Marcela is, I think she's 24, mm-hmm, and Lorena is a little bit older. I won't reveal her age. She'll kill me. But so it's also how these two women in a completely different stages of their life, but it's still colliding and it's still meeting, and but representing the two different roles of women in society today. And it was fascinating because it was a series of reactions of me introducing to them and, of course, being freaked out because I had no clue how much they were going to coincide, how much they were, but it was pure magic. They had so much in common. All three of us, we started talking of how we can change the space and how we can relate and how they can react to their work as they're working, as they're making this particular pieces of work, because all of this work is targeted specifically for the show. Mm-hmm. Marcela did her series of well, they're map boards, but in Mexico, they're called María Luisas, mm-hmm, which is the name of a woman. And the map boards are this essential element in photography. And she makes, but they're such a huge underdogs in photography because they're never considered. So she made them the protagonists and the theme, the subjects of her work, which can also relate a lot to just the roles that we have as gender, I mean, as female and male and female, and who's the protagonist, who is stronger and who will be more of a subject, quote unquote. And she made a narrative of how she starts manipulating the map board or the María Luisa, mm-hmm, until she destroys it completely. So it's,
oh, wow.
It's really, really cool, and I was really honored and excited to see that she was making a series specifically for this show. And Lorena, she's like me, she's very spontaneous, and she works very automatically, so as she started working, as we went, and we talked, and she was influenced by a subject that we spoke in our meetings, and she would just create. But it's mostly about, this series is mostly about her heritage. And she went to Chiapas a few months ago, and she was really struck by it. So it's her indigenous heritage versus the separation from that and this duality of her role in general. So a lot of heart went into this show, I think. And it's really particular now, given the nature of the elections. I feel even more excited to be able to represent this group of minorities, not only women, not only LGBT community, but also, and not only Hispanics, it's just a combination of everything.
Yeah.
And this is, it's kind of exciting to talk about this and to embrace them and to celebrate this breaking of habits and this this duality of identity,
yeah,
and this development of identity and the freedom and the fight of the rights that people are searching for. Women's rights has been happening, that we've been looking for a long time, especially the LGBT community, that they've been fighting so much for the rights just to love in general. Why not embrace it as a whole, as a unity, and make it a sort of a living room setting,
yeah,
where people can feel safe and cozy and also welcomed.
Yeah.
And I think that's what this show is doing, is just celebrating. And it was really cool because during our opening, it was the first time actually having really loud, upbeat music. So it was literally a house party. And it was also a break of environment that we usually do here in Boston Rainer. So is for me, this exciting to see and to have the support of my team, that they were willing to take the risk of doing something completely different and also breaking the traditional aspect of installing and having a show and opening per se. So it's been an awesome experience. And to be able to flip the switch into helping these artists and giving them an opportunity that I'm looking for elsewhere is also really satisfying to see that I'm being part of something greater, even if it's something in the city, small in our community, but it feels like something's happening, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's really good. It's a really good show. And I think what I love the most is the colors. I love the vibrant colors.
The brightness of it, right?
Yeah, yeah. So other than curating shows at Boston Rainer, what do you do outside of it? You obviously still make art.
Yes. I just came from my studio, actually.
Right. Yeah. Which is at Third Street, which is where our graduate studios are soon used to be, because they're moving it over to Fort Mason. What else, other than that, do you still have to work at part-time at this gallery, or?
No, I have a part-time job. I'm actually a bookkeeper and executive assistant for this amazing lady, that she's been really patient with me. She's a real estate investor, so she has several entities that I help her manage.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically do all of her bookkeeping, which is sort of like an accountant,
mm-hmm,
role a little bit. But at the same time, it's been helping me to also manage all the finances here.
I was going to say, that's probably useful for this place.
Yeah. So I'm the person behind the scenes in Boston Rainer when I'm not curating, if I'm not organizing a show, I'm mostly managing the money, doing all the bookkeeping, and the favorite part of the artist, which is paying them and dealing with all of that, which is not the funnest job.
No.
Of running the gallery. It's actually really is the most frustrating and nerve-wracking, because
you gotta make sure all the numbers are right.
Everything that relates to money is just so delicate.
Right.
So,
but it's important. It's probably
but
it's important.
Somebody
it's
has to
important.
Do it, and me being so also picky, I want somebody that could do it right, and
yeah,
that people can trust. So might as well be me and take the burden. Take the burden.
So I always ask everybody this, especially those who co-run Boston Rainer with you, but what is your ultimate goal? Because you're also an artist as well. And you show as well on your own, right?
Yeah.
So what do you see yourself like 10 years from now doing? Like, what are you hoping to do?
Well, at least for I've never been a planned person.
Okay.
And when people always ask me how do I see myself in 5-10 years, I never have a clue,
yeah,
of what to say, since my life has always been a story of incidents,
right,
and me just following my gut, and whatever road is sort of opening, I just take the leap of faith and go for it.
Yeah.
But I think I'm finding myself into a point that I'm going to have to choose a path. Being an artist and a curator, a gallery director is not an easy thing at all, because you're caught between two worlds. It's awesome to give other artists opportunity, but you're also, but my work specifically needs a lot of nurture and a lot of time. And sometimes I feel that I'm not giving it enough time for me to develop as an artist, as my own artist, as my own identity. And to, because the series of 21 drawings has been taking me 2 years and I've barely done 9.
Wow. And they're huge.
Yeah. And for me, and I was thinking about it the other day, and there has to be a time, and right now it's going awesome, this road that I'm taking with Boss and Rainer, but I'm pretty sure that in the long run this is going to meet, and I'm going to have to choose between my life as a curator, director, or my life as an artist. And there's something that I've spoken about with the team a lot, because I'm the only practicing artist.
Right.
Out of the four, and it's not, and there's, and I'm so detached. I mean, I'm so determined to show other artists. And I think this is the hardest part of being a director and an artist, because I always come across with the question, do you show your own work in the gallery? And since my answer is always no, there is a certain disappointment in the people's faces when I tell them that
is,
I don't.
Is that your decision that to kind of keep it separate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I like to keep it separate, and I like I really like the idea of me helping other artists, and I feel capable enough for me to search and to apply in other spaces. And I believe that my work is strong enough to show in other spaces and not fully take advantage of this space that I'm having. Because I have come across with people that curated their own shows and used other artists to promote their own work. And it pisses me off. and as soon as I see it, I just walk out of the door because it pisses me off. And I don't want to be that. I want to be a person that and I want to take advantage of this other practice that I have, which is talking about stuff that I can't talk about my work and
right.
through my work. So it's also a selfish decision for me not to do it, because I want to experiment with this.
Right.
But for me now, my goal in Boston Rainer will be just keep giving to this community and seeing it grow and giving. Exhibiting good shows to people and giving them a good experience and helping other artists while I look for opportunities on my own.
Well, yeah. Cool. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
It was great talking to you.
It was awesome. I blabbed a lot. Sorry, guys. But if you're going to edit it very well, I assume.
It was all good stuff. I learned a lot.
Why haven't we met before, Lewis?
I think because I was in the MA program. And but yeah, I don't know. I don't know why. Doing this podcast, it has given me the ability to meet, to actually talk to the people who I've seen around but never really talked to a lot. And yeah, it's cool.
It's awesome.
So
thank you so much for having me.
Oh, again. Yeah. Thanks for coming on. And real quick, I want to give you an opportunity to plug it. So El Habito is going to be here at Boston Rainer, which is housed at the Minnesota Street Project.
1275 Minnesota.
All right. And until when is it open till?
It's going to be open until December 15th.
Okay.
So we still have solid 6 weeks.
Yeah, that's great.
Come and check out the show. It's really awesome.
Perfect.
And different. You won't regret it.
All right. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
All right, that's it. I want to thank Mariel for coming on the podcast today, and I hope you all enjoyed learning about her and her work. Be sure to check out her recent show titled El Habito at Boston Rainer Gallery in the Minnesota Street Project in San Francisco. El Habito, which features the work of Marcela Pardo Ariza and Lorenza Certuche Diaz, will be on exhibit till December 15th, so go see it soon before it closes. For past, present, and future shows at Boston Rainer, please visit bostonrainer.com or follow them on Twitter and Instagram at Boston Rainer. You can also follow Mariel on Instagram at Mariel Bayona. And lastly, follow the Art Scene Podcast on Instagram and Twitter as well at Art Scene PC. Okay, till next time, everyone.